You're listening to The Audit, presented by IT Audit Labs.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of The Audit. Today, I've got my good friends, Eric Palms and Matt Starland. And today, we're going to jump into the future, or what the future looks like with passwords. I think we all spend a lot of time, you know, figuring out how to navigate the world of IT, and passwords is oftentimes one of the biggest parts of it. So welcome, guys.
Hey, thanks.
Hey, thank you.
Can't complain today. It's 85 degrees out in Minnesota.
It is. I heard that. So it's a heat wave, and people in Minnesota are probably unthawed a little too quick. Maybe that's a problem. People are probably forgetting their passwords.
We still got 20 feet of snow in a Target parking lot, so we still got winter.
Still getting dug out. Well, yeah, guys, I appreciate you guys jumping on. Like I said, wanted to, you know, talk about passwords, all things passwords. So if we're jumping right into it, or, you know, what's your guys' thoughts on how passwords are progressing or not progressing?
So, yeah, I guess, you know, where passwords have always been kind of a big problem for IT and organizations for many years. One of the things you look at from, you know, the attack vectors, you know, social engineering, whether it's through email communication or being somebody calling up a service desk phone number and, you know, acting as maybe an employee and then getting that password reset in that way, you know, and it's funny, it reminds me of a quote that I've heard a few times, whether it's from certain pen testing organizations, but one of the quotes was, what you call hacking, I call taking your password and logging in. So, you know, when it comes down to a technical expertise to do something like this, it doesn't take much. And so that's why you see so many phishing emails come into organizations trying to just build a fake web page and have the, you know, employee log or think they're logging into a web page to gain access using username and password. So traditionally, we've been using that methodology for so many years now. But we look to the government, you know, to maybe actually make a change there. This is a good thing from a government side of the world because of just the top secret data they have to work with. But they've been using cat cards, I think, in the military. Maybe some of you have seen that before, maybe in being in the Marines.
I used one.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's got a chip on that would maintain a certificate.
Similar to your debit card.
Yep, exactly. It's got what they call, it's part of the Personal Identity and Verification Protocol, PIV protocol, which acts as kind of the card is something you have, and that certificate on there is your tied to your identity to get into a system, and then you also have some sort of a PIN code to unlock that. So they've been going, you know, the government at the federal level has this for almost, I think, 20 years or so. But it's interesting to see how a lot of the industry has not fully caught up with that yet, even though with all of these, you know, social engineering techniques, it seems to be that we've tried to band-aid it, you know, using certain tools to prevent, you know, those phishing and processes and procedures. But there is technology that's, you know, been around for a little bit to actually help, you know, prevent these passwords being stolen. So it's interesting to see where the history's been. And I feel like with Microsoft, of course, playing a big role, you know, leading the charge of their Windows Hello or Windows Hello for Business, I think we're going to see this pretty quick here in the next few years, you know, because it kind of takes those multi-billion-dollar organizations to, you know, where everyone has their, you know, cookies all in one jar, we'll say. You know, Microsoft owns just about every bit of identity piece out there when it comes to on-premises organizations. You know, I'm not to, you know, sell Okta and Ping and all those identity providers short, but for a good part, still, when it comes to on-premises, what, you think it's got to be, what, 99% Active Directory?
Absolutely.
Oh, at least.
I mean, I don't know if you guys, have you guys seen anything in, of Novell in the past 15 years?
No, I haven't.
So exactly. So you look at, it takes a, an organization like that to kind of push that forward, and people are going to start, I think, getting on board with it.
Or not have a choice.
Well, that's, yeah, I can go on that part for a while.
I know.
I don't know. It's Palms, what have you, what is your kind of thoughts on this future here? And what are your, what are you seeing on, in regards to some of the news and articles out there that exist?
I think that passwords are going to have to eventually go the way of the dinosaur. Between all of the phishing emails, like you mentioned, that just show up, like, it's hundreds and thousands that are getting that hit each organization daily. And a lot of organizations have fairly good filters nowadays to filter out the majority of them, but it only takes one to get through to compromise a company is the problem. And all they need is that username and password.
Yeah, and that's, to what you're saying there, that's just the phishing part. We haven't even got into the social engineering, right? That is, you know, one of my, if you've listened to any of our previous episodes, you know that's like one of my favorites is social engineering. I've been practicing it for years, and that is what everybody wants to know is, can you get my password, right? So that's like, we're trying to compare apples to apples here, but one thing that's so hard for us to protect is the social engineering aspect, because we can look up the stats all day long. What is it? Between 80 and 90% of all issues, you know, with malicious intent start with an end user, and it's directly related to their password. I mean, so with that being said, is it just inevitable that we have to go passwordless or biometrics or whatever the case is? But to me, that's kind of where things have to shift to, and I think that's where the conversation's going.
Yeah, and folks, you know, with Nick's background on social engineering, you can clearly see that he is social engineering you right now on this episode to buy some services. So look for some future sale events here coming up. So,
yeah, I know.
So that's what your ulterior motive is on this.
I cannot confirm nor deny.
If only everyone could see the grin on his face right now.
Yes.
And he's turning, how red he's turning.
Yeah, we're turning the cameras off. I'm kidding.
No, but yes. In all seriousness, no, it's time to, there needs to be a change in the industry. And I kind of look at it too, is that there's a cost savings benefit here, which I know we can definitely geek out here in a little bit, you know, when getting into the cost of some of these, what do these passwordless, you know, tools look like? But let's say you go passwordless, okay? What does that mean now for some of the products that you currently have, products or platforms that you currently have today that are designed to prevent maybe social engineering? Usually that's the human aspect. So I don't know, maybe that's process procedure there, but Let's think of it from the threat vector. So email, that's one of those threat vectors. So what are we using today for, you know, when I say we as a society or culture, IT industry, what are we using today to help stop those service, you know, those types of attacks? Well, we are using, I guess if you're in Microsoft 365 cloud and you pay for their, you know, E9462 license, whatever it is that you're, you know, of the suite of buffet that they give you to, you know, for every log second you want, you know what I mean? Nickel and dime kind of thing. You know, so you got their ATP, their anti-spam phishing, or maybe you buy, there's a lot of money right now involved in those technologies and services. So what does that mean if you go passwordless? So, okay, great. I click on this, this email that comes in, and they have a fake page that looks like my organization and needs my password or whatever. And I think I'm giving them my password. Well, if I'm passwordless, what am I giving them? You know, so if you're looking at it from the multi-factor authentication perspective, there's a lot of this passwordless is a random generated code or a PIN that you have memorized to unlock a device that then has that certificate on it to prove your identity. So I guess to the basic end user, they're going to think, well, maybe this is my 4-digit or 6 or 8-digit PIN on my device that I need to type in. Okay, great. So I give that phishing webpage my PIN number, okay. So now the attacker has my username and, you know, or if I gave my username or made my email address, and they're now using that 6-digit PIN to try and log into a web application or some sort of a VPN that allows me into my organization, it does nothing because that PIN is associated directly to that device to even unlock it or to gain access to, I guess, from a general terms, you know, to prove that that certificate or hash, whatever they have on that, to prove my identity. So it means nothing. So you've got that tool that you've used to help prevent that situation from happening is irrelevant now.
Yes and no. I would say that it also blocks a lot of malware and such as well, those systems. So sure. I think they'll go less in on phishing and more in on like malware detection, especially when you get to like lay of the land malware. This will build the script on the device from an email from just opening it. Like the latest Microsoft vulnerability for Outlook, where all you had to do was Outlook had to receive the message to become compromised before, if you aren't patched. I think it's going to be a lot more stuff like that in a passwordless future.
And that is a very great point. So while it prevents, so those phishing or those types of organizations, yeah, they would have to, it's not that they wouldn't be, that's irrelevant, but it's all the other services that they provide are going to have to ramp up, because I think that leads into a great point there, Eric. This prevents maybe that social engineering or your password on the internet getting breached, you know, kind of all that, those leaks and everything, or a hash of your password getting cracked. But it now goes into a different vulnerability or a security measure now that those attackers are going to be looking to try and circumvent, and that's going to be like replay attacks. So, yes. You know, once you authenticate, what do you get? You get a security token, SAML token, a Kerberos ticket, something along those lines that proves that you have successfully authenticated, and now here is your ticket or token to gain access to the resources you have. So they're no longer going to be looking for a password, but they're going to try to, how do we exfiltrate or get a hold of that ticket or token to replay it and gain access?
Matt, this is just like the conversation that you and I have had before about authenticating a person versus authenticating a machine.
Yep.
Right? For multi-factor authentication. At what point have you skipped that, right? That's the issue. And that's what, you know, for the listeners, Matt and I have debated this before. At what point are you just skipping it and not authenticating the actual person, but just authenticating the machine? Yes, the machine belongs to our network. That's where we're going to get nickel and dimey, I think. Or you're going to have your issues. Eric, do you have thoughts on that?
Yes, yeah. Once you, especially when it's getting like certificates involved at that point, so there's going, oh, like some VPN solutions are notorious for just running certificate-based only. So you get, as long as the device has a certificate, you're on the VPN. Or let's say you can do the same thing with a website instead. As long as that device has a certificate, they're good to go in, which is kind of scary in my mind. That's where I like where you can do things with devices where if it's an expected location or an unexpected location, either based off of geolocation off IP, you're going to say they're in their corporate office, well, they're much more likely to say, okay, that's real, versus let's say it's in, let's say you only run in the US and all of a sudden you have the machine, you're trying to get a login from, I don't know, India. And then it's like, well, that's weird. You have to look at other factors as well. Like, and then they then hit them with like another authentication method. Like, okay, let's bring up that MFA token at that point to re-authenticate you to know you, this is where you are. Because 20 minutes ago, you said you were in LA and now you're in India. I mean, it's certainly possible with VPN solutions out there right now, but it's very unlikely, especially in the corporate world, to have someone move that fast.
And, you know, too, you're bringing up some great points, Eric. And the problem also is because of the now work from home landscape, we've opened up a landslide of opportunities for people to travel, work from other locations. People are getting Airbnbs in Mexico for a month to escape the winter. And it doesn't matter where they are as long as they got internet, right?
Yeah.
And that, so yeah, trying to detect that anomalous behavior, I think pre-COVID was one thing. Some of the organizations I've seen and been at, you know, it's where they were 100, almost 100% in-person kind of work, you know, hey, yeah, you still came into the office, you did your IT job, and now, so to detect anomalous behavior back then, it was a little bit easier. Now it's much more difficult because of some of that flexibility of being able to drop your vehicle off at the dealership and I'm going to work from there. You know, not saying that that didn't exist pre-COVID, but what I'm saying is because of post-COVID here, life's hybrid workforce is a norm now, and or people are looking to be full remote, mm-hmm. and that makes that anomalous detection a little bit more difficult.
So that's interesting you bring up, you know, the pre and post COVID into the password topic. And I say that because do you think that sped up potentially going passwordless, or just the future of passwords period? Do you think that actually pushes into the future? Because, you know, we look at it like, I think we've definitely fast forwarded from COVID, just the work from home force, right? It was inevitable it was going to happen, but did it happen a lot faster because of it? Do you think it had the same effect on passwords evolving, right? Are we getting new technologies quicker because it's, holy crap, people are scattered all over the place. We need this.
Well, yeah, I would say so, because, you know, again, thinking about some certain organizations that were very in-person work, you know, some of those organizations looked at their trust level as being, well, I gained access to the facility, you know, with my badge. So now I'm in a secured facility where my network servers and resources data is located. So now I can just, now that I'm plugged into my local network or wireless, I can authenticate just fine because I'm coming from within the trusted walls of my physical location. So kind of, I know it's not multi-factor authentication, but it's a form of trust that I'm coming from within the network. And I realize this is the 21st century. We're all on this big zero trust kick now because of how technology and everything's connected has grown. But I believe there was a shift in mentality, at least what I've seen there, because of that. And so now you're coming in from all over the different internet locations. And we all know accessing a resource, an organization's resource from outside within the physical walls poses a whole another different level of risk, to which you want to have multi-factor authentication. You know, that extra layer to prove who you say you are, not the device you come from, Nick, just the, who you say you are. I say that tongue in cheek, going back to what you said earlier, our fun debate we had. In this passwordless, you know, looking at like the FIDO2 technology, like a key like that, or maybe this Microsoft Authenticator type thing where you type a PIN in, something you know, and then it unlocks to either present some sort of certificate that you have, you know, now you're gaining access. So I would say there's, whether a lot of organizations have, you know, determined that or not, but I definitely see the shift going that way, at least from the big players like Microsoft and the FIDO2 technologies of the world. So, I don't know. Palms, what's your thoughts?
Since COVID, I have seen multi-factor explode compared to pre, because it's exactly what you're saying, Matt. It's, oh, people aren't in the office anymore. How can we verify that someone, because let's say they're at their cabin, and let's say their cabin's in another state, in the middle of nowhere. Well, that could easily be them, but we don't know for sure. So that's where multi-factor has come in real well to help with that. I don't think it's perfect, because there are plenty of ways to snag multi-factor. I've seen with some of the new phishing emails, or it'll even, or it's almost like a man in the middle to gain access and grab that token. So, yeah,
I hear you on that part, like the token piece, because that goes, so going back to the multi-factor authentication again, for everyone that's listening, just because you proved your identity through multi-factor authentication, you still get that token. Now there's a, if for any of you that look at Azure AD logs, for example, and are using Azure MFA, you'll notice in those logs that claim was previously satisfied by MFA token. And, you know, because of your identity provider proving that you've already supplied that MFA credential or that second factor, you then get that token that shows, yep, they did the MFA, but so now that threat actor, let's just find that security token and how we replay that, and then they go from there.
It's really interesting topic, and I think we could, you know, you could continue and continue on this. I think there's a certain point that we reached during COVID that we all kind of were so uncomfortable with how things were going. And I say uncomfortable, meaning kind of like pants down moment. We're like, oh crap, we have so many different things to sweep in with our network. Things kind of, I don't want to say out of control, right? But with so many things we had to bring in or speed up. So we got, instead of being a little bit more lackadaisical or going through that whole change management process of how we want to do things, all of a sudden we got pushed so fast. That's what I mean, being uncomfortable. We got pushed so fast to a point where we had to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Does that make sense?
Yes. I definitely have to be.
This sounds like
of COVID.
Nick, I understand you, but this sounds like circular reasoning in a way.
No, I'm playing devil's advocate here because there's, but there is a truth to it all. Like what you guys are saying, I believe that I'm with you guys 100%. I think it was just inevitable. I think that's the answer to the question that there's no, we were always going to end up here. But are we here 5 years faster than we might have been? Are we getting technologies quicker? Are companies releasing things faster because companies are grabbing at different technologies because of like what Eric said, somebody's at their cabin, it's in the middle of the woods in Upper Peninsula, Michigan or whatever. So we're trying to rope all this in really quickly, but we're doing it uncomfortably because we're not used to this.
Well, just ask ChatGPT, it'll tell you.
Man, I was going to bring up something else too.
But even that's 6 months old already. So, I mean, sheesh, it only scraped the internet, 6 months ago? So, anyways, I don't want to digress off that topic. Get on to something else for another day.
I was just going to bring up the fact that you touched on, let's clarify something. You touched on the cost. Are you thinking the cost is it's going to be, it's really great to implement this stuff, or is it really high cost? Or are you saying the cost is so great that big companies are going to lobby against something because the cost of these things are expensive and they want to keep that revenue? What was your thought process behind that?
So now when you're talking about costs, like to implement, like
licensing, all of it.
I think part of it is either one, not understanding what goes into it, you know, all the technology. And I think going back to what I was saying earlier, you know, with Microsoft, say, you know, kind of promoting their Windows Hello for Business and making that much more known. I don't think a lot of organizations, because of maybe certain regulatory compliance things that they didn't have to abide by, just didn't see maybe the worth, you know, the time and effort to even look at it as a need. You know, so going back, why has the federal government, you know, or military been in this for 20 years? Well, because they had very highly regulated data, very sensitive data. So now that is your driver and demand. Now it's not saying that healthcare companies and PCI and all those didn't have that, but I don't know, maybe that just, you know, the federal government, just because of how that data was so critical and sensitive to them, they decided to find that passwordless, you know, way to just needing to make it work. So that was the driver. And so I think part of that was just not people realizing the cost. And I personally believe that with the Windows Hello for Business, I don't mean to keep kicking that one. That's just one I'm the most familiar with. Is, you know, making more awareness around it. And you have the new FIDO2 I put new air quotes around, you know, a few years old or whatever, standard out, this makes it a little bit more, you know, viable because of there's a little bit more ease of implementation than necessarily the PIV, personal identification, personal identity and verification, you know, protocol to stand up. And because a lot of these cloud providers like Octoping and Azure AD have that FIDO2 support built in, and now a lot of web applications are starting to build support for it. So you're starting to see it grow more. And I think as people start hearing about it more and also seeing the cost benefit. So I think that's the initial implementation is going to be rough because there is not everything supports FIDO2, especially from a non-premises standpoint. So for those organizations that have, you know, adopted the cloud identity provider, the Azure AD, Ping and Octas of the world, and where they're using OpenID and SAML to connect all of their cloud applications and maybe some of their on-premise applications too, they have a really simple step forward in actually adopting something like those FIDO2 keys. However, those who have some on-premises applications that are still using forms-based authentication or, you know, along those lines, they're going to have to figure out what are those apps. And then, of course, can we move either one, changing that app over to a SAML OpenID integrated with their, you know, identity provider, or can they go to a Windows authentication, which then means once I've logged into my device using my FIDO2, let's say, key or passwordless, other passwordless technology, you know, then it can pass my credentials through to that application without, you know, asking me for them because it's I've proven my identity coming through my workstation. So there's that aspect of the implementation phase that, you know, there's going to be a big up cost there. But I think long term, it's going to be low because you can go and buy these keys. They range from $20 to $80, depending on what features you want on them, because it's just not the FIDO2 protocol. There's some that have the PIV protocol. There's some that have, what is it, Eric? What was the one? TOTP, is it?
TOTP. Some of them are FIPS certified as well.
Yes. Yeah. FIPS certified. So it depends on what all the, you know, necessities you want on there, maybe for some backwards compatibility, like at the PIV or whatever. But I, you know, let's just say if we just start with a FIDO2 key, you're looking at roughly $20. So $20 a person. But now what does that long-term cost look like from a, okay, breach perspective? What did, you know, now we don't have to, you know, how many breaches now does this prevent from a just social engineering perspective? Do we get to now dial back on some of the licensing or technologies that we had that was designed to prevent, again, phishing? You know, not saying that we can completely go away from just all email security in general, but like you know, you'd brought up that good point, Eric, earlier, but would be is just, you know, there might be some cost savings there too. And then also even support desk calls. How much time is wasted from people forgetting their passwords, didn't sign up for the self-service password reset? You go on and on. And those, what we'd call what, soft dollars, you know, like of just time there, that now you don't have to change the PIN on your key card because if somebody knows it, well, I mean, you can always change it yourself, but even if they know it, they would still have to have that. So I see a big cost savings here.
You took the words right out of my mouth. And I was going to say, how much time, cost, and effort goes into a help desk answering calls solely because somebody's locked out, can't remember their password, so on and so forth?
It's insane. The amount.
It's egregious.
Of lockouts and passwords that have been forgotten because they're on the 90-day password rotation schedule.
Yep.
And what is it now? Is it 12 or to go up to 14 character? Is NIST still 12 or that at 14?
I think 14.
No, NIST is actually down to 8.
They're down to 8?
Yeah, they're
down
to
12 for a while, weren't they?
Only if you have MFA, though.
Yeah, they're down to 8. 8, no password changes, but that's there's two other criteria there. One, you have to have MFA on it. And two, the password has to be checked against a database of known breached accounts. Oh, so like kind of the have I been pwned. Yep.
Yep. Okay. I know a lot of organizations require nowadays like 12 or 15 character passwords, and then they're doing the 180-day reset or 1-year reset still, and it's like, okay, a 15-character password, if you had it for a year, to try and go, oh, I changed it, and then let's say the next day, what was my password? It's 15 characters. It's probably a phrase at this point now.
Well, and the other thing, too, to your point on that is, you know, even though NIST suggests or has that, that again is just NIST, because there's other requirements behind some of those organizations that have to do the 12, 14, 16, and 180 day because of certain regulatory compliance. So it is funny how the different regulatory compliance, there's some, I almost feel a lot of subjectivity depending on who's doing it, because they're not all necessarily aligned either. You know, we always look to, not always, but a lot of the industry, you know, cybersecurity industry does look to NIST to, you know, have done their homework, their analysis, testing, et cetera. But I find it interesting that even you look at that being a federal government standard.
Guideline.
Guideline is this, like CJIS, Criminal Justice Information Systems, that regulatory compliance, though, will say the only way you can go to a 1-year password rotation is if you're like, I believe, don't quote me on this, I believe it's like almost like 16 or 20 characters. But then also the password has to be hashed and salted in a way that it can never be, you know, taken offline with brute force. So if you can't get to that, which everyone knows, Active Directory is still using an old hashing algorithm that, as long as you get the NTDS dump, you can, as long as it's got the right you can take those off and start cracking those. That's almost hard. So I look at it, that might be some sort of not proprietary, but some other identity provider that can hash that. But if you can't meet that hashing requirements, then to your point, Eric, like you're saying, you got to go to a 90-day. And you can have it be, you know, 14 characters or whatever, but it has to be now 90 days. And so, again, every 90 days, hey, look at that spike in the help desk calls that occurs for that particular group of people that have to abide by that, regulatory compliance. So,
and then you get the people who start putting numbers either before or after their same password. Unless they have a password double check application, then it's just, well, the systems to go, well, the hash isn't the same, so okay.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, that you're bringing that up. You guys all have iPhones, I'm pretty sure, right?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
So either way, you can confirm or deny offline, but I'm pretty sure you do, because I think your bubbles are blue. Either way, have you guys seen Apple's kind of doing this whole initiative of hide your email? And they will suggest a password for you, and it will be stored within on-prem in your iPhone. So let's say you sign up for some subscription, right? And you're setting up your account, right? You have the option to hide your email, and they'll put in some fake email that will still come to you. But, you know, it's putting that wall up. Secondary, they're suggesting a password, and it's a very long password. I think, you know, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's like 16 characters, but it's not even a phrase. It's all the things, right? But it's getting stored on your phone, so you don't have to remember the password anymore because your phone's remembered it. So every time you come back to that website, it knows, just like LastPass or other services, DashPay, all those different services, and just puts everything in, fills out everything out for you and logs you in. Thoughts on that? And maybe you didn't know about that, Matt. You sound like,
as you see my facial expression, I am a iPhone. I mean, I can't tell you what my, you know, phone is. No,
we're keeping a secret, people.
Yeah, we're top secret.
You have an old phone, don't Signal. You?
Yeah, so it's I have been oblivious to that. I didn't even realize that, because I use some other password keepers to do that. So I haven't really used their built-in stuff before. So I do find that fascinating. I mean, because of those other password keepers, yes, that makes sense. You know, of course, keep a different password for everything, so that way you limit your risk. Something gets breached, but I didn't know about that email perspective. That is fascinating.
Yeah. So I've known
about that. I don't personally use it because I use another solution. Same. But they do the same thing with when you do the sign in with your Apple account, except that's essentially in SSO at that point. But they will also hide your email there as well, and they'll just forward it along from some random characters at some random character that like fake.apple.com or something. I don't remember the exact formula, but they do the exact same thing there as well for when you sign in for Apple. So let's say you're going to buy some subscription from the App Store. I don't know, HBO Plus or HBO Max. It's when you sign up, you can sign up through Apple for the subscription. It'll just give HBO a completely random email address, and they basically Apple sets up a forwarder to your email. So they never actually have your email. So in the off chance that the company gets breached as well, okay, they have a fake email for you that just gets forwarded along. So they can't go and go, oh, this person has a Gmail email address. Let's try their credentials there and try and get in. It's complete randomness.
Right. Yeah. And so I've been kind of participating in this. And when I say participating, what I've been doing is I'll let my, on my Mac or iPhone, I'll let it create the password. Right. And I'll do that. And then my LastPass, I use LastPass, and then it'll come up on the side and it'll be like, do you want us to remember it? So I have Apple create the password and then I put it into LastPass. So it's like, you see where I'm going with this. So I've been using it. I think it's awesome. Right. I think I wish more people would use it, right? Like our moms and dads, grandma, grandpa, whoever, right? That's really who I feel like this should be getting trickled out to as well, because, all of us got the call from our moms and dads or whoever it is, right? And they're having issues with passwords or can't remember or whatever it is. So then all the passwords for everything are the same, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just inevitable. And that's where something like this is really cool, to see this technology coming out. So it brings me full circle to think, have we gotten to this point because we just outgrew 8 characters, right? Or is it a money thing, right? Or is it just the malicious intended actors have gotten so good that this is the only way we can keep up with them? And it's not really a question, but it just makes me think like, wow, we're coming full circle right now, but how did we actually get here? Right. So it's just interesting, all these things that are going around with different technologies. And I know maybe you guys can comment on it. You're working on a project now to go passwordless.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So the project and stuff that, we're working on is there's a lot of drivers to that besides, just even the cost perspective, So I think it's been a combination of things that we've been talking about for the past, half hour. So help desk calls. For the organization that we are working on to do this, there's a lot of regulatory compliance that is involved. So you have all of these certain groups that don't have to abide by this particular regulatory compliance that's extremely strict. And then you have this group over here. And so you start getting into, okay, wait, which password policy, you try to find this fine balance between usability and also security. As we all know, if you make things so super secure, sometimes it makes it difficult to be effective operationally, and then you start to increase help desk calls or issues because a lot of users just might not be technical enough to figure that stuff out. So for those maybe users that or in those other areas or organizations or departments that, you want to have this password policy for that still meets pretty strict, requirements, maybe meets the NIST requirements. But then you've got another organization because they have to abide by the other regulatory compliance that isn't NIST. And then they have a different one. And then your service desk is getting calls of like, wait, which one are you? Okay, this is the here. So you don't want to make things complex for your organization too. But then you get into the situation where, do I just set one standard now for everybody that they have to be this secure and hardened?
And that's not subjective though. to your industry. And that's where I think the conversation starts to turn, right? Is if you're government or private or whatever, that it really is subjective to that point. So continue on, Matt. I derailed you.
So when you say subjective to that point, can you articulate on that a little bit more?
Yeah,
so
just like, what I mean is you have a different set of standards. Right? Oh, if you're a government entity, you have to follow these rules for a certain reason. You're financial, you're a bank or whatever. You have to meet these guidelines.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what I'm referring to is that, you know, and I've seen in the government industry is because of how, you know, like for, you know, some counties where you've got 25 different departments or something, and those departments are like separate entities, like, you know what I'm saying? So like, so, you know, if I'm working for a Medtronic of the world or some healthcare company, what is my focus? Healthcare. You know, I'll be doing HIPAA. Okay. So we need to abide by HIPAA. And this is our niche, our thing we can focus on. Maybe we might touch a little bit on PCI because payments or whatever, you know, maybe I offload that to another organization to handle the PCI stuff because of the cost. But for the government industry, because of those different departments, you've got healthcare, you've got criminal justice, you've got some IRS rig. There's all over the board. And so for that organization, and that kind of goes back to what I was saying, is like, here's one, they've got these users, they got to abide by this and this, and it starts to create this situation. Then do we just take the most restrictive, which now, ooh, yay, we're under compliance, but only a quarter or maybe less, or I don't know, maybe let's just say for using example, only needed to abide by that. And now the whole organization has to abide by that. And oh boy, now we've got a lot more service desk calls coming up. So I guess the kind of circling back, where does this, you know, why is this so important to go to this type of technology? Well, one, it's because it's simple to use. But then two, it meets all of those regulatory compliance of multi-factor authentication and, you know, and making that authentication so much secure. So that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, the project that, you know, Eric and I are on is to help meet that, keep it simple, but still with good security. And is it going to be fully secure to the point where, oh, we will never have a breached account again? You know, no, because like what Eric was saying earlier, you still got, you know, now you still got the risk of somebody trying to replay your tokens or tickets. But I would think, though, that's much more difficult. It takes much more technical skill set to try to somehow get that piece of software on there. Not saying that it couldn't happen from an email, because now the user goes out and they're downloads it. So there's still that aspect to it. But at least you maybe take some of the other humans, you know, social engineering over the phone now, or might make it a little bit more challenging. At least that's what I'm envisioning, because, but who knows, somebody will get creative again and find another way to get that token off your computer, I'm sure, but
that's a guarantee.
It's something's gonna go full swing. We all went to the cloud. Watch, now we're all scared of the cloud. We're all gonna come back on premises someday. You know, who knows? But I think that's, you know, that project that we're on, that's one of the reasons, is because of, you know, trying to be simple, but it looks like it increases security and meets all those different regulatory compliance. And yeah, it's been a challenge because of the initial implementation of all the systems that need to get adapt to that. But yeah, I don't know. It's Eric, what's your been take on kind of seeing, you know, implementing this and you know, where some of the challenges and hiccups you think are going to be and where they have been?
The core setup is simple for passwordless, because like Microsoft, Okta, Duo, all of them support it natively. It's included with most licenses. The harder part is getting the more of like the SSO setup going to all of these different apps. Now, most third-party SaaS-based apps support it. I've seen plenty of companies who are actually moving away from on-prem to SaaS because of the integration into for a single sign-on stuff is already, they all have it implemented and stuff. The hardest part is your on-prem apps, especially the apps that may have been around for a decade or longer, that have been used, and the people who originally wrote it are no longer there. So no one truly understands how it works on the back end at this point, and they have to go in and try to modify it without breaking it to support these newer things like SAML. Well, SAML isn't super new, but it's one of the better ones out there. So that's the harder part, is that right there. Or if they have an app, it's too old and it's not worth setting it up, and they want to look into migrating to a SaaS application. Okay, well, now that department has to set up a new project to start migrating whatever it may be over to a SaaS application, which then, depending on the size of it, could take a year or longer. If it's a major system, it could take 2 years. So that's the difficult part. It's not the, oh, you have a security key, you plug it in and enter your PIN. That's simple. It takes
30 logistics. Seconds
to set it up. It's the getting everything back end into it. Because I've noticed that there are so many, at least at the beginning of COVID, there are so many disjointed systems, and everyone has different credentials to get into every system. So they may have 100 logins because they use 100 different systems. And now when you're trying to set up like these single sign-on systems, and then you can set up like password lists with them, it's getting them all to communicate with each other again is the truly the actual hard part in it. Yep. Like you can set up a security key in Azure AD in 5 minutes. You can literally, from an admin, probably takes you 5-10 minutes, create the policies, give someone a key, get them to set it up, and they can use that for Microsoft login. Now getting Azure AD, if that's what you want to be, is your identity provider, to go to all the other services, that's the hard part.
Well, it also takes, you know, you got to get buy-in now too. So this is where it comes key, because of those challenges that you talked about with, you know, having, you know, certain applications, whoever's owning them or whatever department might be involved with that. And maybe depending on how budgeting works, and just because IS has a lot of control of some of this technology, but they might not be the actual owners or however their budget is in regards to that app, you know, that could be this old legacy app. And so now this is where, you know, having leadership buy-in on this technology and getting, you know, the rest of the departments or leaders involved and aware of it to see, one, the benefits, but also understand, hey, this is what's going to cost us to get here. And here's what we predict our ongoing cost will be post getting there. Because again, like I said, if we can, you know, market it in a way that, look, we're going to save money here on password resets and time spent on the phone with, time saved for employees getting into their workstations because they forgot their password or now they got to unlock it or whatever. Time saved at the service desk or help desk level now of being on the phone with that employee that is losing productivity because they can't get in. Having to pay for a password self-service reset system, you know, and then all maybe some other technologies that were to help prevent, you know, passwords from getting leaked or whatever. So I think it's very key to also get some good marketing at your leadership level and buy-in and getting, you know, this spread to all those different departments to get on board and to see the value of it. And then hopefully you can then get those resources to react quicker too to your implementation. So
yes, it's a change management issue, right?
Yeah. Just
getting everybody on board.
And that's a big piece there too, is that, wait, how do I use this thing? You know, how do I, you know, plug it in?
Yep.
Or, you know, because it going, yeah. So to your, you know, I know Eric, you said it's simple to register too, but like a lot of people like, you know, to figure out, wait, how do I log into this and do this?
Right.
And then, you know, it's also to the, what does the service desk do or help desk now have to, how many of these do we keep on site? You know, what happens if somebody loses it? So there's a lot of that change management that needs to be developed as well. But I think once you get everything, you know, humming along, there's definitely some good long-term cost benefit analysis here.
Yeah, yes. Like we were saying, the change management portion is huge. Getting that buy-in from everybody. And making everybody understand why we're doing it this way, because not everybody understands the technical side of the house, and rightfully so. They just don't understand, and that's fine. So then I think, right, here's our next question, is at what point is it too much, right? Are we going, I'm not saying we are here with this technology, but is the next step too far? Or have we already gone too far? At what point are we pushing, I don't want to say security, right? Because we're always getting better every single day. We're learning things that we didn't know yesterday. But, right, at what point have we gone too far? At what point is it just an accepted risk, right? That we just, sure, it's inevitable. We can only do so much. Eric, do you have any quick hit thoughts on that?
I know a lot of people that hate typing in passwords. So the people I've talked to, like, I've actually had people come up to me with this project, like, wait, we don't have to use passwords anymore? Like, not with this project. No, you just have to remember a key, a security key. And, well, most organizations have some sort of a badge system to get into buildings and whatnot anyways. Just keep it with that. So then they're much less likely to lose it at that point because, well, if they lose their badge, they can't get into the building anyways or access equipment and whatnot for people who are hybrid or in the office every day. But the idea of, oh, I only have to remember a PIN that doesn't have an expiration date because it's only tied to said device. So if the device gets stolen, then they don't have the PIN, and they're a pretty short lockout on those if someone tries to brute force it, that they can't. I think its fault is like 5 times before it locks it and needs to be reset by an administrator. So, yeah. So the people I've talked to are, the end users I've talked to have been excited about it. It's more of the app users is where I've seen is the pullback and such, like, where it's for going too far. It's those are the people who are going to go, well, this is a lot of work, and is this worth it? But it's the end users who actually truly are enjoying this, because then it's like it's much simpler, and they're small, they're easy to keep on you. Like, or people key on the key ring, because everyone carries their, well, at least for the time being, everyone carries their car keys unless they have like a Tesla or some other EV vehicle where they've gone to like your phone lock-in. So at least for the time being, though, your keys for your house and stuff are still around. So it's easy to keep it on there too, otherwise. So
I'm kind of having some thoughts and opinions on my own question. And I don't think we probably could ever go too far. And the reason I say that is because if somebody told our parents or whoever it was, you know, 25, 30, 40 years ago, when cell phones just started to come out, that a key was going to get sent, or a token, whatever, was going to get sent to your phone, a code, whatever, that you were going to type into a computer to authenticate yourself, we would have thought you were crazy, right? There's just no way that would ever happen, but we're here. So the question I'm asking is like, well, we depends on where we're going to be in five or 10 years. We just don't ever know. We're always evolving. Yeah. But Matt, go ahead. Yeah. You obviously have some thoughts.
Well, I mean, that's like trying to prophesy some major things.
Right, exactly.
There's so many, you know, who would have predicted COVID would have changed the way we lived and worked? You know, it took a major event to just alter life so differently as from just working. So while we can do our best to analyze, you know, the information we have today, there's either market factors, there's geopolitical factors, there's the malicious actor factor. That's a malicious actor factor, huh? The MFF, I don't know that. I had a squirrel moment there, but there's so many different things that can change it. So my just viewing what we know today, it definitely seems like it's the way to go, based off of the, you know, information we have. But I guess I'll just ask ChatGPT tonight and see what it says. And I'll report back on that, and then I'll make that as my final decision.
Yeah, I mean, well,
you come to ahead. Like, you bring up ChatGPT and stuff like passwords, like a computer like ChatGPT has a lot of power behind it. It can crack so fast if someone were to teach it how to, or explain how to. Like, you can chat GPT, you can even use it to like write code, and it's good code for like Java or whatnot. Like, it's not too far to go, oh, I want you to crack this user's password.
Yeah, so, chat GPT, write me a piece of malware that replays a SAML token. Done. Game over. All right, so now what do we got to do to fix that one? We went passwordless, but they found the new weakness in Kerberos tickets and security tokens. So,
and we're in change management meetings all over again.
Yeah, so no, it's just how the industry changes. And we're doing what we can with the knowledge we have at this point in time and thinking this is what we can do best, and something else will come along and we'll figure something else.
All right, guys. Well, I think we beat passwords to death, and unless you guys got any other closing thoughts, I think we can leave it there and maybe have an episode 2.0. Any Sounds thoughts?
Good. I'm good here. I've brain dumped everything.
I am good as well.
Well, awesome, guys. Once again, we really appreciate you guys coming on, and can't wait to have you on another one coming up, but appreciate your guys' time. Thanks again.
Yeah, have a great day. See ya.
Thank you.
Want security leadership without the headcount? As an extension of the team, IT Audit Labs will provide the experts to guide and counsel your company. We will start by creating a custom security program that caters to your industry, while providing transparency and remediation to improve cyber posture while reducing risk. Contact IT Audit Labs to find out more.